Hello, everybody. Welcome to Facebook Live. We're on Zoom. This is Ask the Mayor on WFIU. I'm Joe Wren. And this week, as always, the show on radio airs on the third Wednesday, but we always meet on Tuesday. So today is Tuesday, third Wednesday. We meet with Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Mayor.
Good to be with you again, Joe, always.
Let's start off with one of what we normally always start off with, just to kind of get an update on the COVID situation. Are you seeing any trends? Mask mandate still in effect, or any trends changing that could change that mask mandate?
Yeah, you know, Joe, the trend, we were in a trend of downward cases, you know, compared to 8 weeks ago, we're definitely better. But that trend has gotten a little murky. We are watching very carefully as we look at our numbers. We got below 100 cases per 100,000, which is a benchmark, but we then bounced back up above it. So we're still under the mask mandate in Monroe County. I'm glad we are. I think it's protecting and helping people. We're going to have to keep watching. We're worried with winter here that indoor activities, holidays, you know, as we've talked about before, that can be concerning. So we don't really have a clear trend right now. So we're having to be wary, careful, continue to do what we're doing. I will encourage again, people to get your vaccine, get your boosters. I've gotten my booster a couple of weeks ago, got my flu shot a couple of weeks ago. Those are really important to do to keep us all safe. The hospitals got a lot of people still that are sick from flu and from COVID. So we just have to keep plugging at it. And the more people get vaccinated, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, and if people are confused about the booster shot, the state says anyone can get one if they want one, though there were some restrictions. Are those still in effect, do you know?
You know, Joe, I think I went on the website and answered questions and I got signed up for a booster. I think you should just go on the website. I think if it's been 6 months, if you're have an interest in getting the booster, I think you should go to the website, our shot, and sign up. And if there's a reason you shouldn't get it, they'll let you know. But if you can get it, I think you should go forward and get it.
Let's just get to the controlled burn. It was a couple weeks ago. It released some lead dust particles over a Bloomington neighborhood. Now, this was a training exercise with the Bloomington Fire Department, which was cleared, if I remember from some of the press releases. I've been catching up because I was out for a few days, but by IDEM. And I think everyone right now is just kind of asking or thinking, how does something like this happen?
Sure. And thanks for asking about it. Yeah, on the first week of November, our fire department did what's called a live burn training with a structure, a house that was going to be demolished. It was approved to be demolished, and the owner donated it to the fire department, basically, and spent a fair amount of money getting it ready for a burn. There are state regulations that require you to disconnect the utilities and remove vinyl siding and remove asbestos and other things. And we did all of that. The fire department did all of that to prepare it. These are done dozens of times a year around the state. And they notified neighbors and we did all that stuff that was to happen, and trained almost 100 firefighters during the week on live house burn training, which is really important to keep them up to speed and well-trained. However, on the day that it burned, the way it burned, there was a collapse at one point, which happens and that can happen. There were flakes of lead paint, the paint that came off the house, which we assumed at the time, as we learned about that, may well be lead because they were older, an older house. And that has caused a fair amount of stress, both for the neighbors and for our fire department. You know, these folks, every day they get up and go to work, keeping people safe. That's what they do. That's what they believe in. And that's what this is all about. And then it turns out that this burn distributed some lead paint, which is unfortunate. Everything they did by the book. They followed all the rules. But I think looking back, we wish we hadn't done it and wouldn't do it again. But it's been now about 10 days of pretty intense cleanup. There's been a a very, from the moment that happened, the firefighters have been going door to door and sharing information, doing cleanup. It appears, and eventually hiring actually professional remediation firms to help make sure we're doing everything right, coordinating with IDEM, environmental management, all that stuff. And I can give you an update on what we know at the moment, but right now it appears that there was indeed lead paint flakes that left the premises and hit some areas downwind. It was not a very windy day. We wouldn't have done it if it were. Those are generally cleaned up. There's remediation going on. There's testing going on with air testing and surface testing and ground testing. And so far, all the results that we've gotten back are negative for all of those things, except for the flakes of lead paint that got carried in the plume of smoke. So almost all of those are cleaned up too. And if anybody has any questions, they can contact us. And our fire chief, Jason Moore, has been working 24/7, frankly, to make sure they're doing everything they can. So the short answer is the firefighters did this to train themselves to protect us. They're very well trained. You know, they just got the top ranked rating that you could get, the first city in the state to have that happen. And they feel, I think, very frustrated and regret that this happened while they were training. So they've worked hard to clean up. We're cleaning up very well, and we'll continue to do that and be transparent. There's a website if you want to get more information about it.
I think what I'm also trying to get at too is a little bit more of, you know, just that accountability with IDEM. Is that something that the city, you know, pushes for? Or I think that's what people are wondering is just how does that, you know, how did that get by?
I mean, I used to be the commissioner at IDEM, so I'm a little familiar with that. They have regulations and they followed all the regulations. The Indiana does not have any restriction on lead paint. If you're going to burn a facility, and this happens, I was told there are some two dozen houses burned in connection with I-69, again, used as training exercises. And there's a very strict protocol, which requires removing shingles and vinyl siding and carpets and asbestos, if there's any. The regulations do not talk about lead. Now, there are different states that have different rules, but that's our rule in our state, which doesn't mean Bloomington should do this differently. I mean, we will do it differently in the future, but IDEM followed the state rules, and they've been helpful in the cleanup. They've sent people down. They've helped oversee the cleanup, making sure we're doing everything right. So this is, I think, an example where what the regulations let us do in order to train our firefighters, I think we view now as they need to be tighter, or we need to have a tighter rule here in Bloomington about that.
And then just to take that one step further for the city, you know, Bloomington touts itself as pro-environment, doesn't allow, I believe, citizens to burn in the city because of toxic fumes, yet the city was burning a house in a core neighborhood. Were there any city officials even before this started saying, wait, you know, I don't know, this may not be a good idea?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the open burning rule is actually mostly based on danger we're a dense city and you don't want to have a fire start in one place and blow sparks someplace else. And of course the fire department was on scene the whole time. I knew about this. We knew about this. My view was, let's make sure we're following all the rules. My chief emphasized how important it is. We have almost a dozen brand new firefighters. We've saved 10 lives in this city. They have saved 10 lives in this city over the last 4 years by rescuing people from fires. And their ability to do that depends in part, significant part, on their training. And this kind of training is something you can't get anywhere else. So it was important. But I think the question is, we should have asked is, were the regulations, should they be stronger? We depended upon the typical state regulations that say, if you're going to just burn a structure down for training, which happens again, dozens of times a year, follow these protocols. And we wanted to make sure they follow the protocols. But I think in hindsight, we could have done it differently.
We've been told through some reporting not to gather, harvest anything from gardens in that area. Are there any other precautions that residents in that area should know about?
Well, I think the thing we know right now is that the paint chips themselves are lead paint, and that you don't want to consume those chips. You don't want to break them apart or get them. You know, there is lead paint all over Bloomington, let me be clear. Any house built before 1978 has lead paint on it, and a lot of houses have it underneath newer paint. But you want to be careful with it and dispose of it. You can pick it up with gloves, put it in a bag, and throw it away. The other testing that we're not all completely through, but the other testing about other environmental effects, incidental effects, has all been negative so far, the white tests and the others, but we're not done with all those. So in the meantime, we're asking people to be careful. The website has a lot of details. Paint chips, pick them up with a glove, put them in a bag, throw them away. Leaves, if your yard if you know that it had chips falling on it, you shouldn't mulch your leaves. You should rake them to the side, and we're going to pick them up and deal with them separately.
You know, there's a map provided by the city kind of showing that containment area. We've been asked how that map was created or what metrics were used, because we talked to a professor at IU SPIA and she was doubting the accuracy of that map.
Well, all I know is we've used the remediation certified professionals who do this work. Our fire department is not a certified lead remediation specialist, but these companies are, and IDEM, with IDEM and those companies doing the testing, looking at where they see evidence of deposition of anything from the fire is where those maps came from. And they're kind of defined by different exposure levels. But again, the testing is going to be done pursuant to very strict scientific standards. And that's what's happening now. As I said, so far the results are all good. But we're going to continue to look for those results. And if people have a question, they can go online and sign up or call our office, call the fire department and ask those questions, and we can share that. But the map was done by a combination of IDEM officials and the certified lead remediation firms that we engaged.
Okay. And then last question. Just last night, the city released another press release about the air testing not detecting airborne lead on November 5th and no surface lead on Thursday, November 11th. So I guess the latest information right now coming back from the testing is that there haven't been any indications of lead right now. Is that correct?
With the exception that we do know these lead paint flakes do have lead in them, like much of the paint in our city, but and so those were very sensitive to, and we're looking for evidence other places. We just haven't found it anywhere and hope we don't. And we'll continue to share information as soon as we get it. And again, let me just close by saying firefighters work really hard every day to keep us all safe. They did everything they were supposed to do according to the rules of the state of doing a controlled burn in order to keep them at the best trained level to keep us safe. And we've had no fatalities in the city for 4 years, which is a great thing. However, we learned a lesson here, I think, which is that those state rules, well, we probably need to take them up a notch locally and revisit that. And I don't think you'll see us doing another burn like this in the city.
A 7-line dedication ceremony is set for Wednesday at 11:30. AM. It's a curbed bike lane that's on 7th Street. In addition to that, stop signs also removed, making that street more of a thoroughfare. Are motorists adjusting to the no stop signs, have there been more accidents on 7th Street?
Well, thanks, Joe. Everyone's welcome to come Wednesday at 11:30 if you want to be there for the ribbon cutting and take a little ride along the 7 line. This is part of the bicentennial gift, the bicentennial group of projects we as a community funded in 2018. And it's really trying to create a real strong east-west corridor for pedestrians and bicyclists that not quite like the B-line, but as close as we could get along a street. It's a beautiful new way for bicyclists and pedestrians and buses, by the way, to get across town. As you said, we have changed it to give more direct east-west traffic, fewer stops for buses, bikes, as well as automobiles. It's a thinner street now for automobiles, so everybody watch out and be careful. I've heard of a couple fender benders as we've got a bunch of signage up reminding people cross traffic does not stop. This is not a four-way stop anymore. I haven't heard of anything major, but we, you know, in the changes like that, we need to encourage people to be careful. But come on out and we'll dedicate it on Wednesday. And that the plan is to continue it east past campus, ultimately all the way through to the east side to create another link, a great east-west link for non-auto traffic.
The city had to reconstruct their section where buses couldn't turn. BT Transit said the nose of the bus was going over the other lane, having a problem with those lane widths. So just wondering, I read that the width of the lanes are within specs, but the buses are having trouble. Is that something being addressed, or why wasn't that addressed ahead of time?
Yeah, no, I John Connell, who's the new director of Bloomington Transit, doing a great job. The drivers are doing a great job. Everything's working fine. There were little tweaks here and there with the exact little turn radius on, I think, at Indiana and 7th, but that got tweaked. It wasn't a big deal. The buses are, it's been a common route for buses along 7th Street. And actually we were having more accidents because of the parking on both sides of the road with a bus, with the mirrors and all that was a little trickier than what it is now, I think. And we know the bus drivers will navigate it well, and just encourage everybody to, if you're in a vehicle, be careful and be safe, because this is meant to really encourage and welcome pedestrians and bicyclists as well.
Is there a time frame on the east part of that line?
Joe, no, not yet. We are working on the Greenway, I think, part of it next year. So what we have is from the B line east all the way to Woodlawn on IU campus. If you know IU campus, they've got a pretty good connector through campus along 7th Street by the fountain and the cinema and across there, but then from Jordan East and then on to Union and going east from there is what will be the next phase. And we're working with IU and we're working with the neighborhoods east of Union out to the bypass for the next year to look at what we can do to help keep bicyclists welcome and safe and using this new route.
So other big news, this was just announced this morning, or just a couple hours ago, actually. The city announced a letter of intent with, is it Meridiam?
Yep.
For a citywide high-speed fiber network, something that's been on your agenda since 2016. And you said this in State of the City addresses that high-speed internet should be considered a utility, something such as water in this day of age. So could you begin by maybe explaining where is Meridiam based out of and what sets them apart from others in establishing this relationship?
Yeah, Joe, thanks for asking about it. This has been a really big project we've been working on, and I'm very pleased that we've found a new partner and a new partner has found us. From the beginning, I've said it would be hugely valuable for Bloomington to have fiber to the home. A high-speed fiber network that would cover our city. We have some fiber in the city and some of our providers are expanding that, but they tend to do it in a way that reaches pockets and tends to be higher income and high density places that they'll put fiber in. This is what we've said is we want everybody to have access to fiber. And the other thing we've asked for and looked for is a network that would be open to users, different users. Right now, it's kind of like we have a set of private roads and each company builds its own roads to get to your house to deliver what they want to deliver to you. It's much more efficient and we think valuable for the city to have a public set of roads, not public, but open set of roads. So UPS, FedEx, and Postal Service can all use the roads to get to your house so that internet service providers can all compete. Meridiam has come forward with that kind of project to build over $40 million investment in the city to build a citywide high-speed broadband fiber network that would cover virtually the whole city that will be open structure, meaning there will be a brief period of one provider, but it is designed to be open to multiple users, that meaning anyone from Smithville to Comcast AT&T, if they want to use it, to any internet provider can come to town, get you as a customer, and sell you their internet services. So it's a much more competitive model. There's also a strong commitment to digital equity, which we'll be working on and sharing details later. But we want to make this very much an infrastructure that helps lower income households, households with kids who are going to school, who otherwise have access issues. So we'll be working on those details. But having this is and will be and can be a game changer for the community. So we've been working on it for really for 5+ years, 6 years almost. And we announced today that we have this letter of intent. Meridiam is an international company. They're originally based, came out of France, Europe. They work all across the world. They have a North American company headquartered in New York that is doing North America investments, including digital. And we're their first U.S. They're in Canada. We're their first U.S. stop, I think. And they've been looking at middle-sized cities like us. We're very pleased to be a partner with them in this.
So when you say they invest $40 million, then what do they get out of it? How do they recoup their cost?
They basically, if you think about it, it's kind of like building a digital road system that they then charge tolls to anybody who uses it. So the first thing they'll do is they'll have an internet service provider that will provide internet services and recruit and find customers in the city who they will sell internet connectivity to at very high speeds, gigabit speed, 500 megabyte, well, those. And they will pay the owner of the pipes, the owner of that Meridiam will get paid a lease fee by that kind of company. Ultimately, having a digital network all across your city can offer all kinds of ways for services to be provided. So they build the infrastructure and then lease its access to anybody who wants to use it.
And this is different, just so everybody knows, from just regular internet. This is high speed internet, correct?
Yeah, so comparison, I mean, many of us have AT&T and Comcast home speeds, which may be 25 megabytes up and down, maybe 5, maybe 50, maybe 75 megabytes up and down. Digital fiber lets you get 1,000 megabytes up and down. That's a gigabyte, or 500. And at that speed, it's a very different kind of experience. You know, we've all learned about Zoom buffering and download issues and those kinds of things. And this is the digital infrastructure we should have in America. And we're getting there, but this is an important, really important step forward. It'll really help home healthcare. It'll help home businesses. It'll help home education, our access to the whole digital world, even gamers. I'll mention it'll be helpful for gamers too, but mostly it's like getting electricity in a way. It's a new level of infrastructure.
Yeah. Especially in media, you think about 4K and ultra HD and so forth. What about the local, when we talk about Smithville, uh-huh. I did hear you say earlier that they can jump on this project down the road. Is this something that there's a role for them earlier on as well?
Well, I hope so. And they certainly are welcome to talk to this company. I mean, in a way, this is Meridiam that's come to us and said, we want to invest in your community. It's kind of like a business says, we want to locate in your town. We like what you're doing. And we want to be part of that. They've said that. You know, the current providers' models tend to be, we build the network that connects you to our services. And if we sell you TV or phone or internet connection, we build the line to get to you and you pay us. And if you switch from one to the other, they got to build a different line to your house. This is a different model. I think it's a more efficient model, and we're pleased to be going this direction, because this model is more like our roads, where we let anybody use our roads to deliver packages to you. If you think about internet as a package, we want to welcome competition and welcome people. And it should be easy for you, frankly, as a customer to say, you know what, you're not selling me the services I want. I want to switch. This is much easier to switch because the connectivity is already there and somebody else will be able to step in.
And I think what I've read too from that press release is that this also looks at low income and also the areas that could be annexed, correct?
Yeah, so there's a commitment to cover all of the current city of Bloomington, including all of our low-income areas. And then we'll have to get it finalized, but we expect, and they've committed to say, if you annex new areas, if they become part of the city, we'll make sure they get this high-speed gigabit internet as well.
I know we just have a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about the Bloomington Palo Alto establishing this first ever domestic sibling city relationship. So what's that and what do both cities hope to get from it?
Well, thanks, Joe. Yeah, we're very excited that actually just passed the Palo Alto City Council this week. Monday night, I was on it, I think midnight our time, 9 o'clock their time to talk to their city council. So many people are aware of sister cities. We've called them international sister cities. We have a couple here, Bloomington in Cuba and Nicaragua. The idea of connecting people from different cultures and trying to expand learning and relationships. There's a project that developed called Sibling City USA that I think the backdrop is, man, there's a lot of misunderstanding. There's a lot of stereotyping that goes on inside our country today. There's a lot of divisiveness. There's a lot of hostility even between coasts and mid-center of the country. People think we're different countries and we're different kinds of people. And this is a project that's really meant to say, you know, it would be really helpful for communities to pair up, share information, exchange people, ideas, business opportunities, cultural opportunities, civic engagement in ways that that can tell us, look, just because you're a city on the coast in California, Silicon, the home of Silicon Valley and a big blue state, and you're in a huge urban metropolis, connecting with a city like Bloomington that's in the middle of a more conservative state in a rural area, we can learn from each other. I think the goal is to help knit the country back together a little bit. Remember, we're all part of the United States of America, and we share much more than we have differences. And also, frankly, to make new friends and, you know, have some interesting educational experiences and commercial experiences. And I think the opportunities are really big. They'll be driven mostly by our community members, whether it's a drama teacher or an innovative entrepreneur or whether it's a city council member. I don't know. And we'll find out over the next year kind of where this goes. But I'm very excited. I'm pleased. I think it's a great partnership with again, the home of Silicon Valley and the center of that whole metropolis out there that connects us with in a new way. By the way, there's a bunch of IU alumni out there too that we think may enjoy this connection back to Bloomington.
All right. Well, I know we're out of time. This half hour always goes so fast, but I do like to leave you with the last word. Do you have any other announcements or things that you like to say?
Thanks so much, Joe. I think I would just say we're approaching the holidays. I hope people will be careful and enjoy. These are really nice times, of course, to be with family. But remember, we're not out of the woods on the pandemic. We're still losing people to the pandemic, and certainly people are getting sick. And take care of your loved ones and each other by taking care of each other and being safe. Bloomington's a wonderful place to be in during the holidays. If you want to come down Friday after Thanksgiving, we will have the traditional outdoors lighting of the square, that beautiful event. So you're welcome to come and join us for that around 6:30.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for watching. If you'd like to submit your question, it's news@indianapublicmedia.org. Again, Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Joe. See you next month.
Okay. Bye-bye.